Hello and good morning to our eDiscovery IQ audience. We are so excited about our eDiscovery Intelligence podcast series designed to give you useful and practical nuggets to properly manage eDiscovery in your everyday practice. My name is Melissa Rogozinski and I'll be your host today. Today is Thursday, January 19th, 2017, and our guest today is Carla Bauer, PMP RCA. Carla has been a legal industry professional since 2002, serving as litigation support specialist, paralegal, project manager, and now the founder and president of eDiscovery IQ. We're here today to discuss part one of our budgeting series, the cost benefits of ESI management. Carla, welcome to your own company's podcast series, and thank you so much for being our first guest today.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm delighted to be on my own podcast.
Well, let's go ahead and start first and talk to the audience about why you decided, after 2 decades working in a law firm, why did you decide to strike out on your own and launch eDiscovery IQ?
Well, after I spent some time working in the law firm, and then I worked for a vendor for several years. And working there, I noted that there were lots of times when we would receive cases from small to medium-sized law firms, and the attorneys were trying to make decisions and choices about what they should do and how they should handle certain issues as they came up. And as the vendor, we're, providing our opinion. But they didn't always feel like they could trust it, that we were being, they didn't have anyone on their side that knew what was going on to offer them a counterpoint. And so I decided that this was really needed, and I started talking with a lot of attorney friends of mine that are in the small to medium-sized law firm market and about the challenges that they faced. And I knew that I could help them with this. And I believe that there was a market that really wasn't getting addressed at all at that time, although I feel like a little bit more now, but it's still a very underserved market.
I agree that it's underserved, and that it's starting to get better. And the reality is that we've been dealing with e-discovery officially for about 10 years since the federal rules amendments and the Zubel Lake case back in 2005, so a little bit more than 10 years. But the way that that first decade was handled in framing and defining e-discovery, the terminology, the technology, the pricing, and just overall the methodology, I think it just intimidated a lot of people far more than what maybe the thought leadership group intended. And now that segment is ready to start dealing with it, but I think the segment represents probably 90% to 95% of our industry, and they're a decade behind. So they're starting at, ground zero, a 101 level, and we have to meet them where they are. We can't expect them to find us. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and that's sort of the basis that I started eDiscovery IQ on, was that I can go out and help them in a very one-on-one, non-intimidating way, and to just be able to present that information in a factual way objectively. I'm not a vendor, I'm not selling you a product. I'm just here to tell you this is the course of action that I would recommend. These are my reasons why I'd recommend it. But ultimately, the choice is up to you as to how you want to move forward. And I don't think that, there's a lot of places to go to get that very objective opinion that's not clouded by any other motivation, such as commission from the salesperson at the vendor. I mean, it's kind of, they're not usually going to tell you to do something that's going to cut the budget down by $500,000. That's a hard deal to do when you're the sales guy who's going to make the commission off that.
And we'll address that a little bit later because just like you, I've been in legal for 2.5 decades and I've worked in the law firm and on the vendor side and I've done education as well. So there's a lot to be discussed whether we address all of these issues today or have a spin-off part two to this particular conversation. Let's go ahead and move on with our next question. In your article, Cost Benefits of ESI, which is on your website, the first thing that you address is the myth. The myth is the perception that e-discovery is more expensive than paper. So again, you know, we've both been in e-discovery for 10 years. We both know the facts about this. So let's go ahead and discuss this with the audience. And you've actually got some great visuals to help our audience actually see the cost differential between dealing with ESI and dealing with paper. You want to go ahead and talk to us about that, Carla?
Yeah, this is something that I've said for years, actually since I began. The first case I ever worked on was a huge document production, and we had boxes of paper, and a bunch of attorneys and paralegals had to get on a plane, fly to Utah, go to the salt mine, and pull boxes of documents off the shelves and look at them and decide whether to copy them or put them back and all this stuff. And then they copied them, and when we got back to the office, we had 500 boxes of documents, you know, just full with paper. And that was after they copied them. And there was just so much expense tied to that case. And eventually that case went on. They found their servers, and we had the electronic portion of the case. Now, this was 2004, 2005, about the time that DuBlake was occurring. And so I really learned a lot about e-discovery, and that's where I started getting into it. And the cost of doing the paper was never cheap. And so recently I had an attorney, you know, said that he had done this project and he had printed it out, and, you know, how could I have saved him money? And so I went through and I broke it down for him, and I said, how does this help you save money? So let's take a look at it. So he had gotten a 1 gigabyte PST file, and we looked at three different options: printing them using their in-house tool and using Relativity. And so we looked at printing, which always requires manual labor. There always has to be someone standing at that printer, catching that paper, putting it together, and making sure everything's running. And we looked at how many hours it would take, because first of all, if it's electronic when it starts, you have to convert it over to images to be able to print it all out or open it. And even though that's done by programs, it still takes a lot of time, and anyone in the industry can tell you there's still a lot of errors, a lot of manual, a lot of coaxing that has to be done. So we looked at the cost of printing them at an industry average, 15 cents a page, scanning it back in, putting Bates numbers and Bates labels on, and then copying that to send out to opposing counsel. And the total cost for his project was $3,800.
Well, that's just standing at the copier. That's not even including the billable time for the person actually doing it.
Right, right. And the cost of you paying them their hourly wage to do all this. Now, this one they didn't put into binders, which is something I always say, you know, adds additional cost. Binders, tabs, all of these things are not, I mean, they're not super expensive, but when you're doing it multiple times, it adds up really fast. So we looked at the first option was using their in-house tool. And so the conversion would actually, it would take the same amount of time to convert these to TIFF images or print them out. It's going to take the same amount of time and the same amount of cost. But where you're really starting to see the cost savings is down the line. So that once they're loaded into a database and you can search them and run the production from that database, and then if you can send them out on a flash drive or with, they use ShareFile, their internal file sharing system. If we did all that, we would only have spent $1,650 compared to the $3,000. And then we went ahead and looked at a third option, which was, okay, you have no in-house tools. Let's say we have to send this out to a vendor. And looking at it in that way, the cost was actually slightly lower, although most vendors have a minimum, and some of these could or could not be a little bit higher. But the main thing is that it's certainly not going to cost more than paper, and most of the time it's going to cost less. Because that's another myth that I get a lot is that sending it out to a vendor is always going to be more than doing it in-house. And a lot of times that simply, it's not true if you're working with the right vendor and you've done the right negotiating, because they are oftentimes able to have more throughput with fewer man hours. And so on things like processing, a lot of times sending it to the vendor can be a ton cheaper than trying to do it with your in-house tool that's very limited.
So we've gone from 3,000 to 1,055 in this particular case, this particular task. And that's like, that's a 67% savings.
Yes, and it's a very realistic savings. This isn't a make pretend thing. It's for real. This is actuals. And so there's the sort of comparison altogether of, and doing it in house. Here's an example where it would actually cost more because you have a little bit of a slower, and we did figure out the included in here was the cost per gigabyte for the law firm. Mm-hmm. Because that's another misconception, is that our in-house tools are free because we have them, we've bought the software, so it's free, but you have to buy the storage that it sits on, and most law firms are not equipped to add gigabytes worth of data in one day onto their servers.
And it's not just adding to their servers, it's the human resources to manage those servers, it's the cost of equipment, it's the cost of keeping things updated and upgraded. There's many ancillary costs that aren't often considered or unfortunately kind of forgotten. It's not just per gig.
Right, yes. And that's one of the major things to think about too. And many IT departments have struggled with this for years. Mm-hmm. Backing up a bunch of single page TIFF files is not easy for most data backup mm-hmm. systems. So most law firms will either have to resort to not backing them up very often, mm-hmm. or they, I mean, most of them that I know of, I can't think of anyone, they have to just take that off of their regular scheduled maintenance and backup because it's just not going to happen. Single page TIFFs are just very hard on the backup programs. It takes days sometimes.
Excellent. Let's go ahead and do you want to move on or do you want to add anything else to that? I mean, this example, I just can't imagine that anybody listening to this or seeing this could even have any argument against this. This is fantastic. This is very helpful, I know, to our community that we serve.
Yeah, I mean, the only other thing, in addition to just saving costs, it really builds in a lot of efficiencies too, being able to search for documents and find what you're looking for. It just makes sense. And then if you need documents to review, complex contracts or things that you really need to print out, you can still print them out and look at them.
Just print out the ones you need, not everything.
Don't go wholesale and print it all out. Mm-hmm. Or yes.
Right. Okay. So let's go ahead and move on to the next question. This is something that we're both very, very passionate about. Over the last 10 years, the federal and most state rules have been amended and re-amended to address ESI. Ethical obligations have been solidified through the ABA, and countless e-discovery issues have been decided through our court systems. Why do you think that there is such still a mass resistance to tackling and embracing e-discovery? What are attorneys and paralegals missing or sacrificing if they don't accept the reality of e-discovery?
I think there's still a lot of resistance, just the intimidation factor, the fact that it was all so scary when it first started. I remember the metadata and, you know, everybody trying to figure out what this metadata was and how you see it. And a lot of these things aren't as intimidating as the vendors have led people to believe. And there are many times that I'll sit down with someone and just show them, here's the metadata. This is what it looks like. Mm-hmm. This is what we're able to glean from that document. Here's where it's stored. And that makes them feel more comfortable. The other fun myth side of that is that sometimes on TV shows, they make it look like we can tell everything from one document. And unfortunately, that's usually, that's TV. It's not real. There's limited amount that we can get, but sometimes it can be the most important information needed. And that's where I think people are missing out that aren't embracing e-discovery. If you print out a Word document, fine, but you don't know what date that was created, the person who last modified it, what time they modified it, what modifications they made. Mm-hmm. There is a plethora of information behind that document that can really make or break a case. And I had one recently that it was about a Word document and whether or not the person who sent out the final document had made changes to it. And we were able to prove by looking at the author and the metadata on the Word document that had changed from the time that it had been sent the first time, received, and then sent back out. It was different. And so we could prove that he made changes to it. And that was the case. That was the deal. That was the winner, the key.
Well, and I'll add to this too. Professionally, legal support staff, especially paralegals, and of course attorneys as well, have an opportunity to really grow their careers and become more valuable by embracing technology. I know that where I'm from, back in Birmingham, Alabama, often had, in the last couple of years, I've had law firms that are in their human resources departments contact me instead of recruiters asking me to help them find a tech savvy paralegal. And, you know, I am friends with most of the tech savvy paralegals in that area, and every one of them have been placed or gotten positions in law firms specifically because of their knowledge of e-discovery and technology, their willingness to embrace it. You know, many of them have embraced it early on in their careers, and they have all gotten big fat pay raises as well. And it just makes them more valuable. But the law firms also give them more challenging work, and it's more exciting. And they're really seen as a go-to resource, a subject matter expert. I know about a year ago, well, back in May of 2016, we did, a group of us did a program, we live streamed it through YouTube, called Wanted Tech Savvy Legal Support Staff. And that's on the ESI Roundtable YouTube channel. But again, we spent about an hour talking about how there was five of us, each one of us had embraced technology in a different way in a different time in our career, and how it changed our career and allowed us, in an industry where there aren't actually a lot of growth opportunities and there's not really like a corporate ladder to climb, we were able to progress our own careers and, like I said, get more exciting work, get more challenging work, be able to think outside of the box. And many of them are being paid much better than anyone who's not embracing it.
Absolutely. And when I still remember my first interview at a law firm and talking with the attorney who interviewed me, and in college I had taken some classes for graphic design and different things because I was going to be a teacher and was going to do yearbook and newspaper and all this stuff. And he said, those computer classes you took, I think you'll be able to use that stuff here. And I was like, oh, okay, good, that'd be awesome. And when I started and I went through the, you know, training and learning the ropes, and the first thing they showed me was, you know, I had this wall of pleadings, and I was supposed to go and find these pleadings out of all these binders and make copies of each one every time. And I was like, no, I went right away and just started having them all scanned in. I built a summation database. I didn't know anything about summation, but mm-hmm. I just started there, and I, to this day, can't believe that people don't do that, because there was no way I was going to do that more than one time. to go through all that. I was able to always answer his questions and find the pleadings, and they were searchable too. So whatever it was he was looking for, besides the time that he was looking for the one that had the blue mark on it, that one I couldn't search for. But for the most part, everything else I could look for, how many documents, you know, every pleading about redaction, every pleading where they discussed this or that, all the motions about, you know, each different topic that he would want to see. And I could just search, send it to him via email and not waste time flagging them, taking them to the copy center, copying them, putting them back in the binder. I mean, it was all just way crazy to me.
Well, you know, technology is really not that difficult to learn anymore. I mean, and I'll go ahead and give a shout out to my millennial friends, not necessarily by name, but they have taught me, and this sounds so silly, but they have taught me to go to YouTube or other resources if I don't know how to do something. And I'm now in a place where even with running the ESI Roundtable and doing that live stream YouTube on the Tech Savvy legal support that we did back in May of last year, and even what you and I are doing now and the things I've done in between, I'm self-taught. You're self-taught. These paralegals that I've worked with, they're self-taught. Attorneys, you know, often I have one attorney colleague of mine who has been with me since I've done the roundtable, just since I started it, and he had a case dealing with social media. He started digging around, and because he started digging around and working his way through the social media evidence, all of a sudden he became the go-to e-discovery attorney for his entire firm. And so it's not nearly as intimidating as I think somebody, a lot of people just kind of put this block in their head, and they think technology and, you know, in e-discovery, vendors and the people who have built technology have created their own vocabulary that's different from legal terminology. And the barriers to understanding technology and learning it really are not as significant as people make them out to be. It's very easy to figure this out now, and there's so many resources and so many free resources. It's, you really don't have an excuse to not be able to navigate this efficiently. Would you agree? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, and that's sort of why the basis of starting my company was to help assist and guide and take the fear out of a lot of this. There are so many things that aren't, but there are things that you should be afraid of, and I'm going to make sure you know what those things are, and so that you know, hey, I don't do it like that. Anytime I am walking somebody through like a production, I will explain to them, I don't like to produce in PDFs. Here's all the reasons why, because there's all this metadata that could be attached that I don't know about. And it's easier just to make a one flat rule and say, I don't do that. Now I have some firms that go with me on that, and others that will say, we don't care, we still want to produce in PDF. And I say, well, that's your choice. I'm just giving you, here's what the risks are, and you can go ahead and do it that way if you so choose. But I think that's what a lot of the success of my business has been, is marrying the IT staff with the legal staff, because neither one speaks the same language. And, you know, same thing with the vendors. They don't speak the legal language. And right. So it's almost like there needs to be someone to interpret between those two parties to sort of, and then as they start to get it, I'll have paralegals call and, you know, I need you to, I have a PST and I need you to load this. And they start to learn the language and use it appropriately. And that's always where I feel like, yay, I'm winning this. I'm making progress in the right direction.
Well, and I think, too, the vendors need to understand, those that don't already, and this is one of the reasons I started doing sales training with the roundtable for my sponsors, was the practice of law is not thinking about e-discovery 100% of the time. The practice of law and the business of law is to provide a resource to our clients to help them run their everyday lives and businesses without needing the law. And when they do need the law, when there's an event or a contract that needs to be drafted or there's some kind of a potential conflict, that is another resource for the lawyers to step in and be able to help their clients navigate that, hopefully without litigation. But if litigation happens, then we're there. But again, e-discovery is a component of that. But to everybody, I would reiterate that e-discovery is still just discovery. It's simply an electronic form of the same kind of evidence that you've always been looking for. Your interrogatories, your request for production, your request for admissions, your depositions. None of the discovery process has changed. It's just we have a new format of potential evidence. It's a part of litigation, which is a part of the practice of law, which is a part of the business of law. And we're just not thinking about it 100% of the time. But when we do, then we need people like you and other educators to, like you said, I think interpret is the right word to use to bridge that communication gap.
Yeah, and you know, my experience has sort of been straddled across legal and IT, and I can speak the language of both of them. And it really has, there have been several times where I do have to go in and talk to IT and say, listen, she needs to be able to do this to be able to do the job. And we will go over and look at, you know, what are some things that, what are some different ways we can solve this problem on the IT end so that we're not breaking the policy of the firm, but the paralegal is still able to accomplish the tasks that they need. And when you can speak that language, they're really willing to talk to you a lot of times. And I think that that barrier is kind of what is scary, because IT doesn't understand why the paralegal needs this. And she doesn't, she's not able to communicate what it is she really needs. Mm-hmm. She just says, I have to be able to get this on my computer. And they're like, well, you know, what's the problem? So it's very rewarding to be able to sort of go between those two. Sometimes tough, though. Sometimes they're easier than others, we'll say that.
Well, let's move on to the next question. This is a big one. For those who don't want to let go of paper, what advice would you give them? In your article, you talk about the happy place between ESI and paper. Talk to us a little bit briefly about that.
You know, I don't print out very much. I try to do it as minimally as possible, but there are times I too have to print out things and look at it, and I see the value that can be added. But I think the marriage comes when you're able to leverage both the electronic storage of the documents and the and printing them out when you need it, when it's absolutely necessary. One example I have is where they were looking for a specific formatted document that was a MSDS, and we had all these 5,000 documents to go through and find all the MSDSs out of there. And the paralegal and the attorneys went, okay, print them all out and we'll go through the 20-some thousand pages and find all these. I just converted them to PDF and saved them as single page TIFFs where I could go through a program like XNVO, as you can see. It just allows you to flip through real quick and you can tag documents as you flip through. Mm-hmm. I found all the MSDSs in a matter of minutes. They weren't even done printing them out at that point. And so that's where you kind of have to find where's the good balance. For them, looking through it on the tool that it was hosted in really wasn't going to work because you couldn't get the nice little thumbnails. But once they pulled me in on it, I said, okay, here's what we can do. We can make it into thumbnails and then flip through them. And because they were really old documents that were scanned in, you couldn't search for them because the OCR text wasn't good. So this was the best way, and I was able to, within an hour, I think I had found them all, and they were still printing and getting the first thousands of pages off the printer at that time.
If lawyers and their staff are not embracing technology and e-discovery, What kind of impact does that have on the attorney-client relationship, in your opinion?
I think it makes it very strenuous, and it's even becoming more strenuous now. I talk to a lot of corporate counsel who are just frustrated by the fact that their attorneys don't know as much about e-discovery as they do, and oftentimes they say, "I don't know very much, but my law firm, my attorneys know less than I do. I don't really trust them with this." And so right now we're seeing the corporate clients kind of try and pull that in-house. And I don't think very many are doing are feeling a lot of success with that either. And so I think as if we can get to the point where you as an attorney are able to bring in an expert to engage us when necessary, we can help the client who's got some tools, who wants to use these tools they've invested a lot of money in. We can help them. Let's leverage the best of your tools and let's leverage the best of the law firm's abilities and together kind of take the people, process, and technology and merge those all together. And I think that's really the key to success with e-discovery is if you don't have people in place that are willing to work together, it doesn't matter what tools you have, it's not going to work. And the same for the tools and the process. If your process is a mess, you're probably not going to end up with a really great end product. So having all three of those things and really bringing it together is the key that I have seen many, many times be successful. And people, attorneys that have been on projects before that they just never wanted to see e-discovery again. And then we do the project and we get everything nailed down and they feel totally different about it and are ready for the next challenge when it comes
Yeah,
up.
I met a corporate counsel, Brett Tarr of Caesars Entertainment, and he's just an outstanding person. And I joke, when I first met him, I was so enamored by the program I had seen. It was a webinar I had attended, and then I happened to bump into him at an industry conference, and I thought I'd met a celebrity. And when he sees or hears this, he'll blush and he'll probably text me or something. But I often say that I'm the unofficial president of his fan club. So anyway, but Brett is in-house counsel, and he developed this very sophisticated way to determine basically what it's going to cost to litigate a case or just go ahead and offer settlement. And of the several components of that, he runs a lot of analytics based on where the case is filed, what kind of claim it is, what court system it's in, who his potential defense counsel are, what the history has been in those kinds of cases. And he's able to determine, like I said, whether or not they should make an offer of settlement or if they should go ahead and budget to litigate the case, but also in turn, being able to budget like that, and it does, like I said, it does include what his potential defense counsel, outside counsel, are capable of doing and the history he's had with them. But ultimately, being able to make those kinds of litigation budgeting decisions also has a direct impact on the business itself, because then they can, that's just one cost of running a business. And then the in-house legal department can help make decisions on, if there needs to be additional training with management or employees, or if a certain type of incident is happening at a certain property. They're able to take a look at that, like I said, the litigation budget, and make better decisions to run the business itself. And I think that absolutely lends to outside counsel must become tech savvy. They must have a team in their own law firm of lawyers, paralegals who are tech savvy that can be that go-to resource and work hand in hand with outside, with in-house counsel, or else, quite frankly, they're going to lose that business. They're just going to. If they're not managing things efficiently and they're not saving their corporate counsel money, because corporate counsel doesn't want to have to take things in-house, they're running a business. But if their outside counsel isn't saving the money and isn't embracing technology. You know, Casey Flattery is another one. He was in-house counsel at Kia Motorsports, and he tested his outside counsel on basic technology understandings, you know, Microsoft Word, PowerPoint, email, outlining, basic things, and outside counsel failed. So, you know, Casey Flattery and Brett Tarr both are examples of corporate counsel taking the reins and understanding how to control cost as it relates to the legal process, but it also has a bigger impact on how to run the business. And if outside counsel are not on board with this, and this may offend some, and that's okay, you're going to lose your clients. You're going to. You and I both have heard that from corporate counsel.
And it does happen, and I've seen it happen where it was over the mismanagement of eDiscovery, and the corporate client had to go elsewhere. And that's a reality, but I don't know that they express it outright to their counsel. They keep saying, I want you to reduce costs, I want you to reduce costs, but they're not telling them exactly how, and they're expecting their outside counsel to figure it out and lead them and guide them. So oftentimes when I do something that is done for a cost-saving measure, I will include in the billing description what the actual cost of this process was, but what the savings are anticipated to be from doing that. An example I had of that was running email threading and saving the client. It was a really small case, but I think by using email threading, I was able to save thousands of dollars on a smaller case, but still, it was 30% savings, I believe, was what it ended up being just by doing some. Simple email threading. Yeah, so by cutting it down, 417 documents and reviewing 60 documents per hour, the total client savings would be $3,000. So on something like that, I include that in the billing description, and I try to work with the attorneys to talk with clients to explain to them what is being done to save costs, and sometimes why we're spending money now. Because my favorite saying is, a lot of times attorneys will save a penny to spend $10. Like, no, just spend that penny. It was worth it in the beginning. But a lot of times it's because they don't see the long picture. They don't see the full scope of the project from beginning to end. And I really try to take that big picture approach. And if it's more beneficial to pay $50 extra today rather than $500 tomorrow, why not pay the $50 today?
Agreed. Well, that just about wraps up our time today, Carla. Do you have anything else that you want to say to kind of summarize the conversation we've had? And what do you want the eDiscovery Intelligence audience to know?
You know, eDiscovery is something I'm obviously very passionate about. It's been pretty much my whole career, my whole life is eDiscovery. Sometimes I wish I had other parts of it, but I think my main point was starting the business and really getting out here and trying to, and doing the podcast and doing the blogs, is to let people know that there is nothing to be afraid of. And there are people out here who are willing to help and guide and not lead you down the wrong path. I'm going to tell you what the risks are as you are walking. Now, there are always unforeseen risks. There's always things that come up. I've never had an eDiscovery project that didn't have a thing to it, some sort of glitch in the systems. But a lot of times, if you understand that glitch is okay, and you just explain it to your opposing counsel, a lot of times things just smooth out, and then you're able to go forward instead of halting and spinning your wheels. And I think a lot of the cases that we've seen that, you know, end up with an eDiscovery sanctions or rulings, a lot of times these could have been avoided if we would have started with better communication in the beginning. So I think the clients that I work with now would tell you they have been blown away by how much easier e-discovery is once they decide on search terms and agree to it up front. So now we don't have to keep going back for motions to compel and selecting and doing things like that.
Well, and I'll tie up what you said with reiterating the California State Bar opinion from last year, that the California State Bar issued an opinion making learning about e-discovery specifically an ethical obligation. And they state in their opinion that three things they expect attorneys to either learn about e-discovery. If they don't learn about e-discovery, hire someone who knows about e-discovery, which would be you, an e-discovery IQ, or the third and final option is to refuse the client. And I don't really think our audience wants to have to refuse their clients. So learn about e-discovery and or hire someone like you with e-discovery IQ, and let's get through this together.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Well, once again, everyone, I want to thank Carla Bauer, the founder and senior consultant at eDiscovery IQ, for joining us today and sharing her thoughts on the cost benefits of ESI management. You can learn more about eDiscovery IQ at www.ediscoveryiq.com. Follow us on Twitter at eDiscovery IQ and connect with Carla on LinkedIn. You can also email Carla directly at carla.bauer@ediscoveryiq.com. Or you can reach her at 513-629-2752. Join us next time as we interview Angela Masciulli on budgeting for eDiscovery. That's all for today's episode of eDiscovery Intelligence. Thank you.